Our first speaker is Professor Harry Hale, a native of Texas. He's educated at the University of Arkansas, the University of Cologne, and the University of Illinois, from which institution he received his Ph.D. in 1957. And he has been a member of the faculty of the University of Illinois at Urbana since 1963, becoming professor of German there in 1965. Heretofore, I think it's accurate to say that Professor Hale has been best known primarily as a Goethe scholar and biographer. In 1973, his book, Artist in Chrysalis, a biographical study of Goethe in Italy, was published, followed 2 years later by Invitation to Goethe's Faust. But he has also had a long-term interest in Martin Luther, and in 1980, Doubleday published his highly acclaimed biography, Luther, an Experiment in Biography, which has just recently been reissued by Princeton University Press. This volume deals with Luther in his later years. I think those of you who know it say that it's written with wit and gusto and certainly vivifies and revivifies the older Luther.
Thank you very much, Martha. I want to add a little to my introduction. Actually, some of my first work was with the old 16th century Faust book. You know, old Faust was a contemporary of Dr. Luther. And I really recommend one of those books to you because right on the first page, I believe, you will find an egregious error about Dr. Luther's translation of the Bible. I got my dates all mixed up, and that I want to recommend that to you because not only is this error in one of the most widely circulated of the items that I have published, but also it sort of illustrates that a German teacher is drawn his entire throughout his entire career to the figure of Luther. While I'm making these off-the-cuff remarks, I want to go ahead and make a remark to a student of mine in the audience, Katie Charlotte, who worked with Luther at the University of Illinois, and say to her that we just put up at Illinois one of the very largest displays of early Lutherana. It's surprising that out there in the Midwest so many early Luther imprints should exist, but I believe it's about the largest collection on the other side of the Alleghenies. Now, in that collection, there are two copies of a book in English which came out about 200 years after Dr. Luther died, entitled Dr. Luther's Colloquia Mensalia, or His Divine Discourses. And I have Xeroxed here a part of Captain Henry Bell's narrative from the early pages of this. I really wish I had time to read it in extenso to you, because it's just delightful, but I'm just going to read a few excerpts, if I may. Captain Henry Bell's narrative or relation of the miraculous preserving of Dr. Martin Luther's book entitled Colloquia Mensalia, or His Divine Discourses, at his table, held with divers learned men and pious divines, such as were Philip Melanchthon, Kasparus Kruziger, Justus Jonas, Paulus Eberus, Vitus Dietericus, Johannes Bugenhagen, Johannes Forsterus, and others, containing divine discourses touching religion and other main points of doctrine, as also many notable histories and all sorts of learning, comforts, advices, prophecies, admonitions, directions, and instructions, and how the same book was by God's providence discovered lying under the ground where it had lain 52 years and was few years since sent over to the said Captain Henry Bell and by him translated out of the High German into the English tongue. Captain Bell points out that this book is the book which has caused so many on the continent to fall away from the popish religion, so many that the Pope has had all copies of it destroyed, save this one, which turned up. He says it fell so out that the Pope then living, Gregory XIII, understanding what great hurt and prejudice he and his popish religion had already received by reason of the said Luther's divine discourses, and also fearing that the same might bring further contempt and mischief upon himself and upon the popish church, he therefore, to prevent the same, did fiercely stir up and instigate the emperor then in being, Rudolphus II, to make an edict through the whole empire that all the aforesaid printed books should be burned, and also that it should be death for any person to have or keep a copy thereof, but also to burn the same, etc. However, it seems that Captain Henry Bell had a friend in Germany named Cosporus von Spahr. And Cosporus von Spahr, having occasion to build upon the old foundation of a house wherein his grandfather dwelt at that time when the said edict was published in Germany for the burning of the aforesaid books, and digging deep into the ground under the said old foundation, one of the said original printed books was there happily found lying in a deep obscure hole, being wrapped in a strong linen cloth, which was waxed all over with beeswax within and without, whereby the book was preserved fair, without any blemish. And at the same time, Ferdinandus, being emperor in Germany, who was a severe enemy and persecutor of the Protestant religion, the aforesaid gentleman and grandchild to him that had hidden the said book in that obscure hole, fearing that if the said emperor should get knowledge that one of the said books was yet forthcoming, and in his custody, whereby not only himself might be brought into trouble, but also the book in danger to be destroyed, as all the rest were so long before, and also calling to mind, and knowing that I had the High Dutch tongue very perfect, did send the said original book over to England, etc. Then about, to skip a little bit, it seems that Captain Bell cannot get around to translating this book as he is expected to. About 6 weeks later, after I had received the said book, it fell out that I, being in bed with my wife, one night between 12 and 1 of the clock, she being asleep, but myself yet awake, there appeared unto me an ancient man standing at my bedside, arrayed all in white, having a long and broad white beard hanging down to his girdle stead, who, taking me by my right ear, spake these words following unto me, "Sirrah, will you not take time to translate that book which is sent unto you out of Germany? I will shortly provide for you both place and time to do it." And then he vanished away out of my sight. Well, to make a long story short, Captain Bell does neglect to translate the book, even despite that visit. It turns out that there is according to one of the glosses in this book, that there is a high official in England who owes Bell some money, and when Bell asks for payment, the official clapped him into prison, and there he sat for 5 years, thus being provided time and place to translate Dr. Luther's divine discourses. I'm a German teacher, and I don't know anything to go by except the documents. Now, we do have to judge the documents critically and with love and respect. I would only fault Captain Bell on one point. other copies of that book did survive. The book to which he is referring is one which appeared about 20 years after Dr. Luther's death. It is a Colloquia Mensalia, or Dr. Luther's Tischreden, edited by Johannes Aurifaber. And I'll just write it. I don't know whether my handwriting is any clearer than my pronunciation. Aurifaber was one of the main figures in the church after Dr. Luther's death. He was an editor of the Jena edition. Actually, he alone edited a supplementary volume to the Jena edition, which you may be acquainted with. It's the first time the Passions of Christ appeared, famous sketches comparing the life of Christ, or the deeds of Christ, with the deeds of the Pope and the Curia. Johannes Aurifaber had also been present in the Luther household as a young man, and he was acquainted with the others who had been there. He then got together what he could find of Dr. Luther's table talks and published them in the year 1566. As you've heard Captain Bell say, Captain Bell regarded this as the most important work by Dr. Luther, the work which had brought the papacy down in Northern Europe, and he felt that it would do the same thing in England. Captain Bell is not too far wrong there. I guess that there is no other book that has had such an impact on the German mentality over the space of several centuries, especially the North German concept of family life, the role of the father in the family. But one might ask, is this book by Dr. Luther? Well, I call your attention to the fact that most of the sermons by Luther are sermons taken down, transcribed in the audience, or among his congregation, very often then translated from Latin notes into German, translated then sometimes from German back into Latin. One of Luther's sermons, which was his favorite, put out in its final version by Caspar Krusiger, Luther always deferred the authorship of that sermon to Krusiger. Best known series of lectures is Lectures on Genesis. We have only in the form of that of notes taken by his taken in among his listeners, and then edited, redacted, sometimes rather radically, after his death. That is, authorship in those times was not quite as clear-cut, perhaps, as in our own times. If it be not blasphemy, I would go ahead and remark that some of the most important, some of the most influential writings in our civilization are sayings by people who never set down anything in writing themselves. I might mention Socrates and of course, Christ. Well, this book was also terrifically important for its impact on history writing. As you know, the older Luther, who actually spoke these things, has not been of too much interest to historians. It's the man in his 40s who was of most interest, but many of the so-called facts about the so-called younger Luther have in fact have really been accentuated from these remarks. So it is an important book. I would list one other reason for its being a terrifically important book. As I say, I am a German teacher. Big word for that is a philologist. And I guess that the Table Talks constitute one of the most interesting, certainly one of the most formidable challenges to a language teacher, to someone who would like to know, who would like to be critical of documents and try to judge them. Well, as I say, Aurifaba remained a terrifically influential book in German land. Well, influential in another way, you know, it sort of introduces the concept Gespräch, or the genre of conversations into German letters. Another man who I suppose became better known in his personality than through his writings was Goethe. Goethe's Gespräche are terrifically important. Indeed, German scholarship has attempted understands the word Gespräch, conversation, as a kind of a technical term, and has made the attempt to collect conversations of various great men. Well, as I say, Aurifaba remained an influential book into the 19th century, when Aurifaba was unmasked by the powerful scholarly techniques of the 19th century. They discovered some of the notebooks and sources that Aurifaba had, and were just horrified to discover how Aurifaba had duped the pious for all of these centuries. Aurifaba had in the first place, of course, translated all of the sayings into German, and in doing so, he had subjected them to a rather severe redaction. He makes Dr. Luther considerably more prolix, more talkative. He cleans up Dr. Luther's language considerably. He misses very often Luther's irony, Luther's jokes, not so often, however, as later historians have. By and large, he converts an acerbic, sardonic wit into a fairly conventional, I don't know the word. I wouldn't say piety, because I don't want to use piety in a negative sense, and into fairly conventional attitudes. What Aurifaba had were notebooks collected by his friends during approximately the last 15 years of Dr. Luther's life. One day, one of the older fellows in the Black Cloister, a preacher by the name of Cordatus, Conrad Cordatus, made bold to jot down some of Luther's sayings, and this was in the early 1530s, and as time passed, others of the guests in the house, others of those in more or less regular attendance, would do the same. These notes became very valuable, were interchanged among the note takers. People tried to get complete collections of them. One of our best versions, just to mention a couple of other of the note takers, is a diary kept by a young fellow named Anton Lauterbach. Um, he's very useful. He's very useful because of his dates. We're able to, very often we're able to date or arrange the collections, let us say, by Cordatus in accordance with Lauterbach's dates. Another very fine note taker was Georg Rührer. George Rührer. He's highly skilled in taking accurate notes. He's one of the main editors, both of the Wittenberg edition and of the Jena edition of Dr. Luther's works. We, you know, in our time, we're so impressed with technology. We think that our tape recorder must be better until we actually listen to it. You know, that's mostly myth. I remind you of the Nixon tapes. If we just had Georg Rührer there to take down some of those notes, we'd know a whole lot more about what had been said. As I said, Aurifaba translated everything he had into German. Actually, the question of language is one of the more interesting questions about these notebooks, and it requires an act of the imagination on your part to appreciate it, I think. These were, of course, German speakers, and Dr. Luther may have been speaking German, but German to them was a spoken language, and a language which did not have much of a literary background. For them, the written language was Latin, and believe it or not, well, Latin also had a 1,000-year-old tradition of note-taking, very rich in abbreviations, so that they could take shorthand very well in Latin, or a kind of shorthand. So that, believe it or not, we have a situation where a native German, speaking German, two native Germans, but the note-takers find that they can more rapidly, more facilely, more accurately jot these remarks down in Latin than they can in German. So that the result is what is called macaronic style, that is a mixture of Latin and German. I'll give you just a quick example of the kind of thing. Dr. Luther is twitting Brother Philip again about Melanchthon's proclivity to astrology. You know, he's always dabbling in astrology. And Luther says in Astrologia, sicut ego bibo ein starken trunk bios, quando gravis cogitationes habio. As for me, I take a good slug of beer when I get worried. Sicut ego bibo ein starken trunk bios, quando gravis cogitationes habio. Well, now, what did he say? Maybe he was talking in German, you see. And it was just easier to say sicut ego, to jot down sicut ego and quando gravis cogitationes habio in Latin. But when they came to this very characteristic remark, or maybe they just couldn't in the instant manage in Latin how you say ein starken Trunk Bier. So they switched to German. Or maybe Dr. Luther himself. Maybe we have a direct quotation. We cannot know. We cannot, we shall never be able to reconstruct the ipsissima verba of Dr. Luther. But, of course, Dr. Luther is not here. He exists only, he's totally dependent on you and me for his existence, only insofar as you and I are able to form an image of him, only in our conception is there any Dr. Luther, so that we are obliged to form our vision of what was said there. Of course, we really have two possibilities, at least. There is a received image of Luther, you know, that the historians and others have passed down from one generation to the next. And we can accept that, if we like. I believe that I may be the only German teacher on this program. I believe that most of the your speakers here are historians and theologians, and I need to express my deep gratitude for being invited to. You know, this is one of the high points in my life. On Dr. Luther's birthday, here I stand before the most august audience I've ever had, speaking about the man whom I admire more than any other. But I need to tell you that I am a German teacher, and I belong to a different tradition. I belong to a tradition which flourished. That is, mine is a moribund tradition. It flourished for the last time during Dr. Luther's own day. I belong to that tradition which says that the documents, however faulty, however fragmentary, however subject to interpretation, that it is indeed better to go back to them and let the figure arise out of my own fantasy and my own ignorance and out of the documents than to accept the received image of Luther. And I think that I should, in gratitude for the invitation, make clear the rather radical difference between my approach and that of the historian. You know, Paul Murray Kendall, the author of The Yorkist Age, I believe in a sort of depreciating way, spoke of historians finding the past to be a seedbed for the present. And this is especially in Marxist history writing, you know, one looks upon the past as the origin, as having the roots of present day situations in it. Sometimes even worse, one goes to the past in order to confirm present day notions. Historians also feel, I think, that they can explain processes in history. I mention those things just by way of saying that I, a foreign language teacher, don't really approach the past in that way. I really do not feel that I am able to explain it. I approached Luther as a biographer, and my entire purpose was to allow the man's personality, the man's individuality, his character to arise in my own mind, to obtain some vision of Dr. Luther. I did rely rather heavily on the table talks to do that, not as heavily as some of my reviewers have accused me of doing, but I did rely rather heavily on the table talks, so it is appropriate that I should stand before you and confess to that. I want to stress, however, that the vision which I obtain from the table talks is very ephemeral, very, very, very transitory. As Professor Lotz pointed out, I wrote this book in the late 70s. I probably would not see the documents in the same way now as I did then. Certainly 4 or 5 years I will not. Certainly I would not expect another person with a different background from mine to see things in the same way that I do. This is of the nature of documents. I repeat, from my point of view as a foreign language teacher, all I have is the documents and my own fantasy and ignorance in interplay with the documents. Let me tell you a little bit about the Luther household, where these documents arose. We have a letter from the time warning a gentleman passing through Wittenberg not to call on Luther because the household is just too full of children, women, and confusion. He was responsible in the sense of providing them room and board. And you know, Dr. Luther not only had students, but he had students of students. The Black Cloister was a place with a whole lot of guests. People passing through, the pastor's out of a job, and this kind of thing. It's in this environment, as I say, during the last 15 years of his life, that we have some of these people, of prominent ones, perhaps a dozen in all, taking notes from time to time. No particular set of notes, of course, runs the entire 15 years. We have quite a few overlaps, but we have note takers coming in and out. They're called table talks, but actually they're notes taken everywhere over the house. One time Dr. Luther is walking in his garden and frightens up a little bird, and he says, that's exactly the way it is with the dear Lord. You know, we're so frightened of him, but he feels he has the same warm feeling toward us that I have toward that little bird. It does not know that I would never harm it. This sort of thing. Well, Luther was aware of the fact that these notes were being taken. There are various ways of showing that. My favorite way is one time when a widow of some 2 weeks came to Dr. Luther and let him know that it was time he began looking around for a new husband for her. And he immediately wheels around and says, "Schreib das auf, Schlagenhaufen, write that down, Schlagenhaufen." He did not want to withhold from posterity the kinds of outrageous requests that were being made of him regularly. The Dr. Luther's strong language, which I'll be coming back to later, also is relevant here. These were young men, mostly students, future preachers, and of course they were eager to get down all of the nuggets that they could for use in sermons later, so that this may affect the kind of notes they took, may give us a slightly slanted impression of what was going on there. There are certain just overwhelming themes in the table talk. The question of law as opposed to grace, for example. Countless illustrations of this. This certainly reflects Luther's preoccupation, but it probably also reflects the kind of note takers that we have. You can be sure that these young fellows did not let a single improper remark pass. And I rather imagine that when Dr. Luther noticed that they carefully jotted these down, that it probably spiced up his language all the more. But it is precisely this humorous, this wit, this sardonic approach that makes the table talk so very difficult for more sober historians. Let me give you just a quick example. We find a group of table talks. Perhaps they were later grouped. Perhaps they represent something that was going on all at the same time. The fellows are sitting around to see who can tell the biggest lie. Dr. Luther starts it off by saying, "Now, you know, they were bringing a hay wagon in the other day. It's August, and a fly sits down on the hay wagon and cries out, 'Look at all the dust I'm stirring up here.' Well, this sort of game is a difficult one to play because each person then tries to tell a bigger lie than the one before. And Dr. Luther finishes this one off also by saying, you know, heaven, that's where all of our earthly wishes are fulfilled. Well, you know, this may escape our materialist culture, because this is the kind of heaven we believe in, is it not? This is certainly the Marxist heaven. The German word is Schlaraffenland, fool's paradise. But to Luther, this was funny. One subject of jokes at the table was St. Anne. There was a lot of discussion. You know, this is the mother of Mary, and there was a lot of discussion just toward the end of the previous century about the Immaculate Conception. And even the writings of the Church Fathers on this subject may sound like off-color stories to us sometimes when they get into the exact manner of the concept of the Immaculate Conception. And of course, this provoked the fellows around the Luther table and provoked Dr. Luther to make this and that remark. Anne, for example, there was quite a bit of folklore about Anne. She was reputed to have had three husbands, actually. Art historians in our time believe they have discovered that Anne was a sorceress, because they feel that they can show a lot of icons, a lot of drawings, which demonstrate Anne rendering little babies, men and boys, impotent. They thought that this was one of, you know, that's a rather well-known trick of a sorceress, and Anne was reputed to have this ability. Well, Anne was also the patron saint of the miners, and this was mining country. You know, Luther came from a mining family. Anne's name is attached to some of the towns in that area, Annaberg. So we can sort of assume that Luther and his students knew as much about Anne as we do. One time Luther, you know, one of the major themes at the table talks was all those bad years in the cloister. And one time Luther was characterizing those years in the cloister. He liked to use figurative language. He said, Anne was my idol. Thomas was my apostle. And others went running after St. James. Well, translated, I believe that means I was celibate. Anne was my idol. I was a doubter. Thomas was my apostle. But he doesn't admit to believing in good works. He says others went running after St. James. You know, James is the book in the Bible which Luther deprecated as preaching good works. The straw epistle, as he called it. He wanted to consign it to the Apocrypha. Well, then another time, you know, in the table talks, Dr. Luther says, this is one by Anton Lauterbach, and it's in Latin, and in the third person, so I'll repeat it that way. It's exactly at this time of year that I went into the cloister in Erfurt. I beg your pardon, it's in third person. It was exactly this time of year that he went into the cloister in Erfurt. He was on his way back to school from home and passing through the village of Stottenheim. He was so frightened by a lightning bolt that he cried out, and now Lauterbach switches into German and a direct quote, "Help, Saint Anne, I will become a monk," but the dear Lord understood Anna in Hebrew, where it means by grace and not by law. Well, you know, the interesting thing about that is that is our entire documentation to the vow to St. Anne. That's all of it. There is a letter to a school chum in which I think it's Mucianus who says, who refers to some, there was probably some Damascus-like experience that Luther had, or at any rate, we get that notion from a later letter by a friend. But insofar as the vow to St. Anne, this is it. It seems to me pretty clear that the most obvious thing about that story is that it's intended humorously. As to just the nature of the humor, I wouldn't know. But it's humor and figurative usage which have made the table talks most inaccessible to more literal-minded, more serious-minded people. There is another thing, I have to admit. And as I say, I'm very honored to be before such an august audience, and I just don't know how I'm going to proceed without using improper language, so I want to beg your forgiveness way out in advance. You know, Dr. Luther had great contempt for the flesh and the world, and his pious desire to express this caused him to speak very strong language. That is, he referred to himself as a bag of worms. And of course, then times passed, the Victorian glaciation descended on us, when, out of piety, people avoided precisely the kind of language which piety had driven Luther to use. So it leaves us in this difficult situation. The table talks today are available to us in the version prepared by Ernst Krokoff of the Weimar edition around 1920. Croker called our attention, and he had reason for doing so. I'll get back to that in a moment. Croker called our attention to a remark by Dr. Luther about music. You know, Luther was a great music lover, a very deft musician, and would praise music constantly as most dangerous to the devil. Luther said at one time, "Oh, music, such a wonderful gift, that the dear Lord should give us music here into this house, and into this outhouse." Yeah. Well, another time, Dr. Luther said, was explaining a justification. The justice of the Lord, and it's a pretty good explanation, and so we have many, many copies of this particular explanation, but of course we have it better elsewhere. But you know what he had to say, that there was a time when I thought that the justice of God was something exacted of us, but then I gradually perceived that it was something granted to us. Now, such a skill, such a kunst, such an insight as that the dear Lord gave me into this, and to use the same word again, into this life. Well, we have many copies of this. Probably our best copy is by Georg Ruhl. But old Cordatus got into the act. He wasn't there, but Cordatus very piously copied down as many of these as he could, and he made several copies. He would copy and improve on his copies. Cordatus has the very annoying habit of adding information every time he recopies. And one of his copies, and he'll put it right into Dr. Luther's mouth. We have many examples of that, and this is kind of an egregious example. Right after this remark, he just could not withhold letting us know that he had been a guest in the Luther household, and he knew where the privy was, and so he added, "In the tower." Well, that was all right. Aurifaba did not use that. Aurifaba recognized Luther's figurative language. So there was no trouble caused at all until these scholars arose in the 19th century. And Cordatus was their favorite source. I remind you of the fact that Croker did not come along with his edition until the 1920s, so that in the times of Heinrich de Niefle, for example, when the Lutherans felt under powerful attack, in the times of Hartmann Grisar, we had the chief edition of the Table Talks was put out in St. Louis, in the St. Louis edition of Luther's works, and went according to Cordatus entirely. Hartmann Grisar, the most widely circulated of the Luther biographies, when he comes to the discovery of the gospel, quotes Cordatus, and then does him one better. After that, in the Tower, Grisar adds, one can almost see him pointing with his finger to the very place. Well, this just caused terrific consternation among Luther biographers. They began to investigate the Black Cloister and found that the privy probably was indeed in the Tower. They argued, no, we have reason to think it was heated, so perhaps the study was in the Tower. One of them suggested that one of the abbreviations for cloaca, for latrine, might be clausa. And so it was argued that this was really his study. But this is a particularly important usage of the Table Talks. A fellow who wrote his doctoral dissertation on the Table Talks was Preserved Smith, very much under the influence of Freud. Freud was taken to be a scientist in those days. And Preserved Smith said that we just have to... Preserved Smith says that we just have to accept science, you know. This is an aspect of Luther's personality. Paul Reiter wrote a two-volume study of Luther's psychiatric problems, and Paul Reiter said that he had friends who wrote lyrics, who were lyricists, great lyric poets, and some of them had their best ideas in the process of defecation. There arose here, I remind you, in the early 20th century, all of this nonsense, which found its way into Erik Erikson's Young Man Luther, from there into John Osborne's Luther, and from there into the Luther movie, and into countless psychoanalyses of Luther. All of this has no footing anywhere earlier than after 1911. That is none of them. So that I guess I'm not talking about the Table Talks anymore. My time is running out, and let me just summarize right quickly by giving you my notion of the importance of the Table Talks. In the first place, the Table Talks are an excellent document to the times and to the character of the older Luther. I stress in passing that they tell us nothing, or next to nothing, about the Luther of the so-called Reformation years, the Luther of the teens and twenties, although they have been used or abused in that manner. They are, in the second place, a very important challenge to the philologist, challenge to the foreign language teacher. We can learn a lot from them. In the third place, and I think Dr. Luther would like to stress this importance of them, they serve well to humble the arrogance of the human spirit, especially among intellectuals and professors. Wenn die Bauern bloß wüssten von unseren Disputationen, sie nos explodierend et exhibierend. If the peasants just knew the subjects of our learned discourse, they would hiss us and hoot us. Thank you.
I think we can, since we started about 10 after, I think it's only fair that we have... time for perhaps one or two questions, if there are any. from the floor.
The question is whether where one might obtain access in English to some of the earthy flavor of Luther's expressions. This is one of the great ironies of history and of Luther's life. You know, Dr. Luther, I have argued that he did not break with the church, that he broke with establishmentarian scholarship. However that may be, Luther is our parade example of free translation, of freewheeling translation, of translation based on the principle, to put it in Luther's words, first you have to understand what the Hebrew man said, then turn around and say it in your native language, forgetting how he said it. That is, Luther is our parade example of good translation. He has never enjoyed good translation, to my knowledge. That is, the translations of Luther tend to aurifaber him. The statement from the floor is that historians are good foreign language teachers, too. That's an example of Luther's translation.
Very good.
Is that it?
Thank you very much.